Hello, Internet. My name is Walter Ciades Fedchuk, and it's the most wonderful time of the year here on the Rough Drafts Podcast Network. It is Final Cut, coming to you, not live, but pre-recorded, but being released on Christmas Day. This is our first Christmas Day episode, and I'm very excited for it, which means we're also going to have a New Year's Day episode next week. That probably won't happen again for 6 or 7 years, which if this podcast is still going, then, man, Chase and I have had a lot of things to talk about. with that being said, I can think of no one that I would rather spend your Christmas morning with, talking to, other than my good friend, Chase Redshirt King Wassenaar. Chase, how are you doing on this lovely Christmas morning?
You know, I'm doing great because I feel like we are providing a public service, so to speak, by still having an episode coming out on Christmas Day. I know most podcasts, you know, it's like a very reasonable time to take a break, right? Just based on, you know, especially if you have a lot of script writing or whatever else in there, you're away with family. But I think enough of us have had that experience where it was like, man, now that the basic Christmas morning festivities are over, it sure would be nice to have a podcast I could retreat to instead of whatever the hell's going on with my family over there. And now that's what this podcast can be. I'm glad we're doing it. And I'm glad that we have a guest on the show today to really help bring in the Christmas season with us in our film we're talking about today.
Absolutely. You know, we are not like other podcasts where we have, you know, years of content that we could re-release talking about, you know, the Duke of Frankfurt and how he, you know, murdered 1,000 pigs and lobbed their heads at poor people or something, you know, like behind the bastards. Nope, we got to give you guys fresh new content. And of course, Chase did mention we have a special guest, which he knows a lot better than I do. This is the first time that I have met Justin, Chase's friend, and the ringleader of, I guess, LA's pretentious movie night with Chase and his friends. So, Justin, what is pretentious movie night?
That's a great question. It is a thing that my friend, Chase's roommate, Brendan, started about a year ago last November, where we each rotate and select a movie from the pantheon of pretentious films. So it could have been anything from a Bergman film, or I subjected Chase and Brendan to Haosu in October. So it can reach really any range, but something deemed pretentious.
Subjected or allowed us to be entranced by? Really, I think
I prefer the latter. I really like to think that it's a journey that we go on together when we watch Haosu.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a lot of foreign films, which I've really loved. And yeah, just like an excuse to watch a whole bunch of things that I would not see otherwise. I think it has helped. I like to think that it's helped my film critique lens, though I don't know how much of it applies to the film we're talking about today. That really feels like an animal of its own to some extent.
Yes, I would say the movie we're watching that we watched for this episode and are about to discuss is not pretentious. But speaking of not pretentious, you know, it is Christmas Day. And I thought, I don't think we've ever talked about our favorite Christmas films or holiday films because we are a non-denominational podcast. Even though I was raised Presbyterian, but I'm agnostic. Chase was raised Catholic. Justin, again, I just met you, so I don't know what you were raised. But listen, if you want to put that Adam Sandler film on here, by all means, I will allow it.
I am a Catholic school
boy. But Justin, let's start with you.
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
Former Catholic schoolboy. But no, I have to go with the classic of It's a Wonderful Life. I feel like a touch cliche going with that. But it is something that my dad and I used to watch all the time. And like I was mentioning to Walter earlier, I went to school in Syracuse and would make the drive back to Ohio where I lived during the holidays and would make like the effort and go out of my way to go through the town that it was kind of based on and shot in.
That's yes, pretty cool. Absolutely. Seneca Falls, New York, the hotel that is there will air It's a Wonderful Life basically beginning from Thanksgiving, you know, Black Friday, all the way to Christmas Day, in the hotel lobby on a projector. Also in the, you know, the Finger Lakes region, Skidi Atlas on Lake Skidi Atlas, kind of in between Syracuse and Seneca Falls, is also really well known for having like Dickens, you know, Christmas Carol kind of weekends where people will dress up and roam around the streets, and, you know, the shops will have cocoa and things like that. So it is very picturesque here in the Finger Lakes. But listen, there's nothing wrong with loving a classic, especially if you have, you know, that memory of watching it with your dad. Chase, what's your favorite holiday movie?
Well, first of all, I do need to just bring up that apparently this year, a horror dark comedy called It's a Wonderful Knife came out. I did not know that was a thing. I don't think it needed to be a thing, but it apparently is a thing, and Joel McHale's involved. So
we love Joel McHale.
Just a little fun fact I uncovered while looking to see when A Wonderful Life came out. But no, my favorite Christmas film, it is specifically the original animated Grinch Who Stole Christmas, the one that is like just a direct lift of the Dr. Seuss story. It's a whole 30 minutes, which is exactly as long as it needs to be. I feel like every Grinch film after that has gotten lost in the shuffle and in this idea that like, oh, well, we need to expand it to a full length film. No, you don't. It does exactly what it needs to do in the time that it took to do it. And it does so brilliantly. It's a very fun, cute story. Good moral lesson at the end. The Grinch's heart grows three sizes, and so does the audience's. And I don't know what else you need from a Christmas film, honestly.
Jim Carrey.
True.
No.
That is.
I was
going
to say, we need, I'm not sure we need a little bit of hoovelation.
No, but yeah, Grinch is Still Christmas. It is absolutely a classic, and you know, I can understand maybe having the original preference for the animated one. That's the one I grew up on, and when the Jim Carrey one came out, I thought it was a nice homage. But yeah, you're right. It's not. It doesn't quite hit the same way. With that being said, I also have a relative classic. I do want to give. Man, I know Tim Allen is a rough, you know, person to kind of support, but I do love the Santa Claus. I do. It's one of my favorites, but the ultimate favorite, the original stop motion, The Year Without a Santa Claus from 1974. Mm. I'm a sucker for all of those stop motion movies. That Santa Claus is Coming to Town. But The Year Without a Santa Claus with the Miser Brothers, that those songs are just, they stick in my head from Black Friday all the way through Christmas Day. And then they disappear and they come back a year later. So I appreciate them. I love that movie so goddamn much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those Rankin animated films are definitely a classic.
But with that out of the way, perhaps we have a new holiday favorite for you, the lovely listeners at home, or perhaps for Justin, Chase, or myself. We have watched John Woo's Silent Night, not to be confused with apparently there's a horror movie called Silent Night that came out like 10 years ago. The 2003 Silent Night with Joel Kinnaman. And right off the bat, I remember when it was announced, seeing on Twitter, everybody being super excited with John Woo and seeing what he had, you know, had for us. Chase, do you have much experience with John Woo as a director?
Not as much as I'd like. It's very possible that there are some films up here that I'm just not putting names to that I've been shown, either as part of Pretentious Movie Night or a similarly adjacent effect. I obviously know of John Woo, his legacy in action films, and a lot of the shots that he helped create and refine. There's a style in film that can be traced back to a lot of the work that he put in. And certainly you look at something like Face Off, Mission Impossible 2, those are two kind of more mainstream American films that I have seen of his that I enjoyed quite a bit. But, you know, for me, it's just like, look, this is a guy who really has his, you know, his clear directing chops specifically for action films. Someone who I think, you know, has certainly been an influence in where we've seen John Wick films go, which has become my favorite series of action films. And here we have this like Christmassy bent to it. And in an ambitious way, the silent in Silent Night is not quite fully literal, but as close as you're going to get. It's a mostly dialogueless film. So that's enough of a twist to me to go, okay, I want to see what you have for us here, John Woo. I want to see what drew you to make this and how you pull this off and whether you pull it off, which is really, I guess, what we'll be unpacking over the rest of this podcast.
Absolutely. You know, Face Off, one of my favorite movies. I forgot that he was the director behind it. Mission Impossible 2, the early Mission Impossible, is my favorite out of there. And then Wind Talkers, which the Navajo, you know, kind of breaking down the Navajo code breakers and Nicolas Cage, you know, being a Marine that's tasked with protecting them. I remember watching it. I feel like it's probably a little underrated. But Justin, in the pre-call, you were talking about how you have a little bit of experience with his Hong Kong movies. So what do you see coming from John Woo's past sort of into the present, and what were you expecting going into Silent Night?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have as much experience as I would like, but I did rewatch Hard Boiled last night, which is like one of my favorite of his. And you get that like gritty, his older films from Hong Kong are involving so much, like there's a lot of gang violence, like police on gang action shootouts, and that really carries over to this. It almost feels like kind of the connecting thread through it. I was actually reading last night that he made Hard Boiled in reaction to some of his earlier films being so gang focused. So he was like, okay, well, if you think I'm making pro gang movies, I'm going to make a pro cop movie. And that's why he made Hard Boiled. And you can kind of almost see that thread continue on through to Silent Night.
This is definitely a film that does not portray, the good guy isn't in a gang, right? He's not associated with gangs. It is a gang commits horrible violence to a suburban dwelling person, and he goes on a vow of vengeance that takes him a year to prepare and is completed in one silent night on Christmas Eve.
But Walter, did you consider that the gang goes to a playground at one point and hands out some cash to some random kids? Clearly not all bad.
I would give them pass. I would give them pause and go, well, they're giving money to kids, but that is a well-known tactic of a lot of these gangs, are to, you know, ingratiate themselves into the community. And that's, you know, sort of what they do, is they provide for the community. They take care of the community. And, you know, the only thing is, you don't snitch on them, you don't talk to the cops, and your kids have to join the gang and be their drug mules. That's how these things sort of go. But that brings us to what the actual film is. And a brief kind of plot synopsis here. A father played by Joel Kinnaman, his son is murdered in front of him. Drive-by shooting, you know, stray bullets. And he goes to chase after the culprits. And when he catches up to them and kills one or two of them, a gangbanger shoots him in the throat, destroying his vocal cords, missing his spinal column. So, you know, thankfully he can learn how to fight them, but destroying his vocal cords, rendering him mute, essentially. And he vows, upon, you know, after wallowing in the, you know, the drunken stupor of, you know, what would normally happen to a child that lost a parent that lost their child, eventually, you know, has this sort of dream, you know, in his drunken stupor, decides he's going to get revenge, and then marks Christmas Eve as his target date and spends the next 9 months learning self-defense courses on YouTube. And the funniest thing in this film is buying surplus body armor and drilling it into the inside of the 2016 Mustang that he purchased, which is just absolutely hilarious. Knowing that premise, you know, Justin, do you think a suburban father would be able to learn how to take down a gang just from watching YouTube videos?
See, that's the thing. And I think Chase and I were talking about this as we were leaving the theater, is like, he shouldn't be. He should be bad at this. And there are a few moments throughout the film where he kind of is, and he kind of messes up, or, you know, gets a little in over his head. But I don't think a year's worth of working out, you know, tutorials and whatever, and not seeing a single combat maneuver prepares someone for a silent night like this. And I kind of almost wanted them to play that up a little bit, because there's that like little irony that runs underneath the like last half of the movie of like, he's really not prepared for this.
But he throws up when he kills that person.
He has the one moment where he pukes, and then like the night before he kind of gets beat up quite a bit when he kidnaps that one gang guy to get information out of him. But there's such a difference between the competence that the film seems to think that he has and that the film wants us to believe that he has, and the things that he actually does, right? Like collecting the information on these gang guys, right? There's that whole sequence where he like goes into the cop's room and is taking photos of like the most wanted signs that he will then use later in that like flash drive he sends over to like point out these things. And it's like, one, the most wanted posters are not like hidden in a police station, right? They're meant to be either distributed or publicly available, so people are on the lookout for these most wanted individuals, right? The idea that you would have to sneak into a police office to get these pictures is insane. But beyond that, right? Like you get this flash drive of notes that he's taken in, and like the signed paper with all of the details that he gets from this this man that he kidnapped clearly has blood on it, right? That's not admissible evidence. That's not helping anything. And there aren't any like meaningful details or proof of this stuff. It's just like a whole bunch of arrows and things for like very broad baseline relationships. But it's meant to be presented as like, look, Mr. Cop, I did all the investigation that you should have been doing. And like, it's a mess. It's an absolute mess. And
none of it is proper evidence at all.
No. And none of it would even be that helpful to people, even beyond like whether it could be used in court, right? Like, if the cop had been given this several months beforehand, what would he have done with it? There's not... It's messy and it's sloppy, and that's fine if the whole point is that this is a revenge fantasy, which is very different from the revenge reality. And I thought that was where we were going to a certain extent, right? Because it is so much of this idea, you know, this masculine stereotype that, you know, you can just, you know, if I just had a year where I didn't have to do anything but work out and train and all this stuff, I could become a badass like you see on those action films. Like that, God, there was a poll recently, right, of like 70-something percent of men believe that they could land an airplane in an emergency situation. Like, there's just this idea that people get that they believe they would be capable of this. And it's like, that's not how reality works. But, you know, even though he, you know, gets beaten around a little bit early, and the initial car chase where he, you know, he kills that one guy and pukes, like, everything else, he is not only a badass, but he's a badass in things that weren't even explained in the very extended montage. Like, I don't remember the bomb delivery part of that one, or when he learned how to ride a motorcycle and display the gasoline so that he could light it on fire. Like, there's a lot here that the film is asking us to suspend our disbelief for better and for worse.
I will say, his Google search history must put him on some sort of watch list somewhere.
You'd have to
think. Listen, he uses NordVPN. Like, what? It's 2016. Like, come on. He's got to have a VPN, right? But no, like, you know, I get it, right? It is ridiculous that you would expect this person, because, you know, we talked about the killer a couple of episodes ago. This guy is a hitman. He's an assassin. We talk about John Wick. He's an assassin. We talk about Bullet Train. The dude was an assassin. Like, all these things, right? This isn't even like fucking Die Hard, where the dude was a cop, right? Or a detective. Like, this dude, the only thing we know about his background is there's one moment where there's this flashback to him getting home after work, and he gets out of a company vehicle that looks like it's for like a utility or like a electricity, like, like, you know, electrician company or something like that. Yeah. That is all we know about this dude. And he likes to like fix stuff in his garage, right? He likes to like fix little electronics and everything. So when he brings out the trip mine, I'm like, well, obviously the dude is handy. He's got some mechanical, you know, DIY stuff. Like, of course he's going to make a fucking trip mine out of you know, some fishing line and a can. Like, come on, why not? But it is the physicality aspect. And there is a scene where, you know, he kidnaps the book guy, right? The counter, essentially, for this gang. And it's a messy sequence. Again, it reminds me of in The Killer when Fassbender is fighting against the muscle guy, right? It is this very ugly, kind of brutal fight. But he still wins. He still gets the upper hand. And, like, there's the fight in their house that house that happens later. And I'm like, yeah, you know what? It'd be pretty realistic that if I was, you know, kidnapping someone, I wouldn't think to take the knife out of the dish drainer, right? Like, mm-hmm. Why would I ever consider that? He was smart enough to put on, like, you know, a welding helmet. But, yeah, there's, like, an effortlessness to him fighting this gang of hardened criminals that is pure fantasy. It's not reality.
I'm almost, because I think the trailers misrepresented the action in this movie a little bit, because I came out of the movie feeling like it was a little stiff. Like, it still had that punctuation to it. He was very cool. Like, he cleared out these guys pretty effortlessly, especially the car scene where he's shooting and drifting around the shootout. Yeah. Crazy. Mm-hmm. But watching other, like, having watched Hard Boiled last night, it almost feels like, because John Woo is so good at like cool guy action. I mean, he practically made Bullet Time or whatever. Is like Hard Boiled, you see you know, guys like sliding down staircases and flying through the air in slow motion, and it's like that whole John Woo aesthetic. It almost feels like he tried to do, well, what if a guy didn't have that magic ability to slow down time and jump through walls and jump through windows and stuff, but he in execution has to still be cool. Like, John Woo can't not do cool action scenes.
Mm-hmm. You know, it would be like, I think there's a way to compromise this that wouldn't change a ton of the film, but, you know, instead of like the detective being kept to the wayside until the last second and this like weird kind of more like the idea that like, oh, this cop just wasn't doing enough and you needed this angry dad to do the work that should have been done all along by this detective. You know, he could have just gone to the detective earlier, right? And you know, like, maybe, you know, we understand in films like Ocean's 11, right, that everyone has a skill set. Usually there is a driver, and that's like their one job is to be the driver. Or you'll get people who are particularly good at breaking and entering, or particularly good at, you know, the actual, you know, tip different types of explosives or guns or whatever, right? And it would not be hard for a film like this to have like, okay, maybe like there are a couple people who are also parents who have all lost something and they're all kind of coming together to take this down. The problem is, that'd be really hard to do without dialogue, because you kind of need people to talk to find common ground so that they'd want to work together. And since this film has chosen not to have dialogue, you can't really have that communication outside of like a couple texts here and there, a couple muffled words of admonishment from some character off screen. There's no way to build that, so this one guy has to be everything. And I don't know, I feel like maybe the film suffers a little bit for that, because it's actually kind of fun when the detective finally shows up and gets to bring his own skill set to it, right? Like, that's I think, something that would have been nice to play around with more, that the sheer format of the film doesn't really enable.
I wonder if that's the point, though. I wonder if there is a reason that there is no dialogue besides a, like, whoa, wouldn't it be cool to do a film with no dialogue? And one of the things, and I've said to both you in the pre-call, that between me watching this the day I watched it and then the next day when I woke up, right after I watched it, I was like, huh, I wonder, like, what did no dialogue add to this film? Like, really, like, didn't really need to have no dialogue. And I was like, no, I don't think so. I don't get it. I don't understand it. And then the next morning I woke up, I hopped in the shower. I was having some shower thoughts and I was like, oh shit. I wonder if the no dialogue is on purpose, because I think, and maybe I'm reading too into this, and maybe it was just John Woo woke up one day and just said, hey, this would be a cool idea for a film. There is an aspect of masculinity, right? It is very pure that this film is a masculine movie, right? I'm going to get revenge for my dead son. I'm going to work out. I'm going to go kill these fuckers. And I'm wondering if it is some kind of social commentary on masculinity's inability to speak their feelings, right? And to talk about internally what they're feeling. And I'm coming from this super, you know, man's identity, right? Not from like a more modern take on like men are allowed to be soft, men are allowed to, you know, talk their feelings, things like that. You know, the SJW shit that the alt-right likes to complain about, right?
Men would literally prefer to lose their wife and then lose, you know, die in a blaze of glory, killing an entire gang rather than go to therapy. I get you.
Yeah. And I wonder if the fact that at the end we have that letter to his whether they're divorced or not, but his wife, where he's like, I'm sorry I couldn't do what you needed, but I had to do this like my way. And there's just the one solitary tear that comes down her face. Is like, I wonder if that's the point. And I wonder if this isn't supposed to be some like, you know, praising of, you know, revenge films or anything. I wonder if it's trying to be critical of them. In a way.
I mean, certainly I think it's playing on that toxic masculinity stereotype, right? You know, so much of what he gets involved in and how he's choosing to confront this stuff is based on that idea. And I think your read that this was done as a, you know, like, you know, guy is not capable of talking about his feelings. I think that's a huge part of it from a thematic perspective. You know, John Woo has talked about this in some interviews. You know, and it seems like he wanted to use, he wanted to tell a story where the visuals were really the key, using music instead of language. And the movie is all about sight and sound on a tight budget, something that he thought was creatively interesting to him, too, you know. Right? So there's a little bit of both, right? I'm sure the symbolic interest is definitely there. It also just seems like the kind of project he wanted to take on and that people were excited to give to him because he is the kind of guy that historically has made a lot of visuals and this kind of film work. I think the problem with that is that I don't think the film is willing to condemn this guy or the path that he took to get here, right? Like, I think the film, given how it ends and given the sentimentality that is constantly being brought to him and how we're meant to empathize with his loss, you know, him bringing the gift at the end there, like there's a lot of time spent to try to keep us on this guy's side, right? There's a lot of time that is spent trying to build up this idea that like something needs to be done about these gangs. A lot of people are being hurt. And the problem is that no one's willing to do anything about it. That's a theme that rides throughout a lot of different elements of the film. So does he go about it in an unhealthy way? Absolutely. But I think, at least from how I felt watching the film, I felt like it was arguing that, well, that's what needed to get done. And that's where he found peace at the end. I go back to the final shot a lot when talking about this film, because you would think, right, like we're kind of trained in cinematic language. When we see like a flashback or you know, like a reflection of a, you know, his dead child in one of the Christmas decorations as he is strangling the gang leader to death here, and he sees his child's reflection, typically we're supposed to associate that with this kind of I don't want to say earnestness, but certainly like this idea of like innocence, right? This is meant to be like a reflection point, something that should make you look inside yourself and your conscience and say, am I doing the right thing? Is this the thing my son would have wanted? Would he be proud of me if he saw me here strangling this man to death? And the film's answer is yes. Like, he sees his son and just goes harder, which blew my mind when it happened. Did not have any expectation that would be a shot that we would get, or that that would be the character's response to that shot. But that is what we got. And I think the film kind of portrays this idea that he's allowed to find peace because he did it. So if that's meant to be a condemnation, this toxic masculinity and inability to open up, I don't know that it stuck the landing or was trying to even. I mean, what about you, Justin? Do you agree with
that? Yeah, I don't think it did. I think that's a really interesting perspective. And I think one that would have been better implemented with dialogue. I think it's an interesting directorial challenge to do that without dialogue. But yeah, I do come back to that last shot a lot, Chase, because it's so out of pocket. It comes out in, like, he's strangling a man, and then it's like the Christmas orb. It is an orb. Like, it's not an ornament. It's this huge gold orb that, like, reflects his son's face smiling back at him to, like, his ghost is now satisfied that his killer is dead. Which is crazy.
Yeah.
And I think, speaking to the point of, like, masculinity and how this kind of tackles it, it's, like, it's really interesting, and I wish they had, because I think other films, and action films in particular, deal with mostly silent protagonists a lot, but then the people around them speak volumes, and, like, do a lot to help those scenes, and I wish this film had done more of that, because I think it's equally impressive when those movies do that with minimal dialogue as well. Like, I think minimal dialogue is almost more impressive. Like, you take, you know, John Wick 4, I think he had like 400 lines, and a fourth of them are one word or whatever, like however many are, but like, you get so much world building and thematic building from everybody around him, and I think that's almost more impactful.
I definitely agree with that, because it feels like it's trying so, like you said, Chase, it's trying so hard to get you to emphasize with this guy, right? And be on his side. And it's like, right, a gang shot his son. Like, that shouldn't be that hard to convince me to be on his side, right? Like, we all understand that, but there is a lack of emotion, right? There's a lack of, like, anything to grab onto besides this. It's not even, like, hatred, right? He doesn't even, like, hate these people in a way. And there's not this, like, cool calmness that you get from, like, a John Wick. It's just more sociopathic and just more of, like, I put their names down in a book and I put a date on a calendar and, like, I have to do it like I'm doing my taxes. And, you know, it's even when he's, like, choking the dude out, it's not like he's, like, you know, it's not like he's trying to make, like, screaming sounds at him or anything. He's just, like, staring at him, and his eyes are, like, bugging out like he's fucking Edge, the wrestler, and is just, like, but it doesn't convey, like, anger, right? And there's no sense of relief that happens when he finally does it, and when he's looking back up into the baubles and is seeing this, you know, alternative universe where his son is grown and is, like, graduating. Like, there's no smile that comes across his face. It's just like he's emotionless. And again, that's why I kind of fall back into this, like, is this the point? Is that the point of the no dialogue and the entire thing? Is, like, this is the wrong way to process grief. But then, yeah, there's no condemnation. So you don't get the catharsis of the emotional, you know, outburst, right? Of him avenging his son's killer. And you don't get the condemnation of him being like, well, he's also a murderer now, right?
Well, and I think, like, you know, my favorite scene in the film is not any of the action stuff, though I think John Woo is still very good at directing action scenes. It's the scene at the hardware store where he's coming out and he sees this kid who looks a bit like his son, and he kind of imposes his son's image and, like, goes to hug the kid before the mom, like, realizes what's happening and takes the kid away. Because that's trauma, right? Like, that is a very human, very common trauma relationship, seeing your loved ones in these kinds of different places and transposing them onto other people in your inability to, you know, or as you struggle to process their loss, right? That's an incredibly human moment, and one that I could have used a lot more of instead of an extremely extended sequence of montages. Like, we're not going into it because there's really not a lot to take away from it, but I would say at least a third, if not half of this film is just training montages. Like, it is a huge portion of its runtime that gets covered in the Wikipedia in like three sentences, because there's not a lot of plot there. Just like, we're trying to paint this idea that like, he sure is training. And that again is something that like, sure, maybe not having dialogue plays around with some of those themes, but you know, it would also play around with those themes, some conversations with people about the training that he's doing, so that we don't have to see every single individual step of it to believe that it's happening, which we're going to have to suspend our disbelief for anyway, because it's still absurd no matter how much time you spend on that sequence. So I don't know. It's a shame, because I think if that's the goal, I think there are parts of the film where you can see that leak through, and we don't get enough of it. Instead, we get a lot of these like flashback sequences where like the color changes a bit, and it's very kind of melodramatic. You know, him playing soccer with his kid in the yard, and then suddenly the blue filter goes back over the camera and the ball's just sitting there now covered in mud. And it's like, we get it. He misses his son, you know, like
so much.
I don't know.
I think the pacing was really surprising to me, because I think, again, the trailer kind of sold it as this big punchy action movie that was going to be, you know, breakneck and not like let up a lot, like kind of similar to how, you know, John Wick movie is or something. But it's a large majority of the movie spent on both flashback and training montage. Which was surprising, because I actually, one of my favorite parts of the movie is the opening. I really liked the opening sequence, because I was like, oh, we're in this. It's like, it opens on him sprinting down the road. He's wearing his bloody Christmas shirt, and he's chasing down these two, like, gang members that are having a shootout, and it's, like, fun and exciting, and I think we get all the exposition we need visually really well in that opening sequence. Like, he goes to the his wife goes to the hospital after he's shot, and is like clearly looking for him. We see the newspaper of like child shot dead, and it's like, great, I know what's going on. So like, this is the pacing of the movie, right? And then it's like, they just tell us all of the like things that we got from the visual language early in the film. It's like, the film almost was worried that we wouldn't understand that his son died Christmas morning and now he wants revenge, which is pretty simple to get. Like, I understood it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of the whole thing the film is, actually. Yeah, it's a shame.
It is like a stupidly simple premise, right? Like I said, it doesn't take much for me to be on this guy's side. They killed his son in an accident. Like, I get it, right? I don't need you to convince me anymore. And it is wild to me. We bring back, going back into, you know, the information he gathers, right? Like, they show all these training montages about him like working out and him doing self-defense and him going and, you know, going to the shooting range. And then this long sequence where he's like learning how to drive a Mustang. And like, honestly, hey, if Ford paid you for that, it works, because out of that sequence, I wanted to buy a fucking Mustang. Like, I wanted that Mustang, that color right now. That's what I want to be driving home in. I get it. But then there's nothing about like, he just instinctively knew how to like collect information about how to bug these people, or like how to wiretap them, or like how to find where they lit, like where they operated. Like, how did he find out any of that information? Like, that would have been the interesting part, the setup, right? The like casing the joint aspect and turning it into like a heist movie, where the heist, the thing you're stealing, is the mob boss that's inside the building, right? They could have done all of that. And then instead, yeah, we got 45 plus minutes of him in his basement doing pull-ups.
Yeah.
Which is just like crazy.
Another thing that's weird to me is like, along with that, is during those moments, what you'd assume, like, what a good screenwriter would do is lay little, or like even good director would be, lay little eggs that'll hatch later, like lay those Chekhov's rifles that'll come back. It's like I was waiting for him to do, like, mess up a self-defense move during training, and then later that same situation comes up and he gets it right, or like, you know, some sort of, like, that's where you lay those little things that then come back and are the exciting action moments later. But they don't have many of those. There's one or two. But it's mainly like, oh, he, you know, he puts the bomb in his bag, so he's going to use that later. Or, like, he uses it. Yeah. It's just the preparation. There's no real forward momentum there. It's odd.
Why is there not a soccer ball or a train set at the gang's place? I mean, besides the fact that we've just decided that the gangs don't have fun, like, we've seen them interacting with kids, right? So the idea that they would have presents for children somewhere on the premises, or that one of them would have, like, model trains as a hobby, right? Like, those are things that we spend a lot of time on early in the film, and they're just not present during the part that's meant to be the, like, the pinnacle of the film.
Yeah, like, if we wanted to have, like, that would be a great, like, moral dilemma to have, if there's, like, a children's set or, like, a plaything there, and that would be the visual language of, like, oh, maybe he's become the thing that he's been set out to kill, yeah. Or, like, have some sort of depth to that. It's just odd. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's circle of violence, right? Because you were mad that your son's not there, now there's going to be a kid who grows up without a dad. Is that, have you made the world better by doing that? Like, that would be an interesting thing for the film to wrestle with, and it feels like it should. It's kind of crazy that it doesn't. But here we are. Yeah.
It feels like that's not the point of the film, though. Right? And it does feel like if it's not this commentary on you know, toxic masculinity or grief or how, you know, improperly processing it, then it's just a mediocre revenge fantasy.
Well, you could say, like, cycle of violence. I mean, yeah, to a certain extent, I think you may have pinned where this film comes down when we get to my ratings. But, like, maybe, I mean, there is, like, a cycle of violence angle to it, right? Like, he does not take up this revenge quest if the gang didn't bring violence to this, you know, suburban neighborhood. That is a direct violence begets violence. It's already in the script. Sure, like, you could say every revenge story is like that. Yeah, exactly. That's why that theme is there and so common in films of that genre. So I don't think you would have had to change a lot or add a lot to have that matter and be more prominent. So I don't know. I still think it's a missed opportunity.
Or at least, like, balance it so that we have, if it's going to be purely, like, fun revenge flick, you know, then balance the, like, flashback training montage to be the first act of the movie, and then let's break mm-hmm. into the action and get some really good beats throughout there. But
yeah, maybe the second act involves him trying some things a few days before Christmas, and he has, like, room to fail a little bit, right? And we could see him get better over time through experience rather than backloading everything at the end. But
yeah, again, how did he get this information? Oh, it's that he started fucking grabbing the drug dealers off the streets, and, like, one escapes and, like, goes, oh, there's some, like, crazy dude in a Santa mask that's, like, grabbing your drug dealers. And then he, like, runs in to, you know, grab one, and, like, there's, like, five armed guards, you know, five guards that are there, and he has to, like, run away and be like, well, he knows I'm coming, so I have to use what I have. Like, I ran out of time, right? I had all these little side missions I could have done to try and chip away at the mob boss. And now instead, like, instead of it being a 1 out of 5 difficulty, now it's going to be a 4 out of 5 difficulty, and, you know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then it would have been a different movie. It would have been a much, much different movie.
I mean, it is interesting to think about, right? Like, you have the two things I'm left wondering is, one, how could this premise have worked, maintaining the no dialogue, just by making some different pacing decisions? And the second thing is just, like, what if we did have dialogue? What if we had more with his wife, and we did get to go a little bit more into the grief and the inability to express emotions and the way in which masculinity can be processed through a lens of violence rather than, you know, violence and retribution rather than recovery and rehabilitation. Those things you can't really do with a dialogueless film. And so I'm kind of left feeling like this is one where maybe John Woo's ambition was beyond what this film was capable of addressing. Which isn't to say that there aren't some things about it that I enjoyed, but it is to say that I think that even if we agreed that some of these themes that we've discussed were things that he did or did not want to focus on, it is very difficult to do it with this script and with this pacing. One of those two things needed to change. And unfortunately, I don't, you know, here we are.
That's well said. That's well said. I think that's a reasonable assessment to be like, hey, if you've got an idea, right, you have to go and lean all into the idea. And it doesn't feel like that he leaned completely into the idea, right? It feels like he said, we're not going to have any dialogue in this film, but then didn't have a good rest of the film really written around it. Rather than like write a really, really good film and then say, okay, let's take the dialogue out and what's left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think.
Yeah, I mean, like.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask you, Justin, what's your, like, you could be the script doctor here. What were the changes you would have liked to see this maybe live up to what you think its potential was?
Yeah, I think, I mean, like I said before, I think I would have made that training montage and I would have no flashback, first of all, because I think we get it. But I think you just cut down that, like mm-hmm. we're saying, it's you cut down the training montage. I would have loved to see them get into the action quicker and like start that mm-hmm. quote-unquote silent, if it's called Silent Night and you're resolving your entire plot in one night, why is the one night quote-unquote like the last 20 minutes of the film, the last 30 minutes? Mm-hmm. We should have gotten in there immediately, had like turns, you know. I love a movie where you get into a place and then you realize, fuck, we got to get out of the place. Of like, I would have loved to see him, you know, get to the top, kill the head, realize that he really fucked up because now, you know, who all is swarming to the building. Or it's like, I would have liked to see some sort of like structure to the action beats, rather than like, okay, we have a car chase and then we're going to go to the headquarters and we're going to get to the top of the headquarters and then that's that.
Well, and you know what film this year did a really good job of that is John Wick 4. Yeah. John Wick 4 did a fantastic, like, that entire last hour or so, I think, is all done in that extended Paris sequence, right? Which has multiple different action beats all taking place across the same night, culminating with that long climb up the stairs and the duel at the end. Like, that is all essentially one really extended sequence across numerous different locales within the same city, connected by this clear tissue of John Wick has to get to the duel in time and there's a crazy high bounty on him that means everyone else is going to try to stop him. And you could have done a similar extended sequence for Silent Night easily. You know, just by having multiple different gang locations, maybe he's taking out both gangs rather than just the one, or he starts by like trying to get the two gangs to fight each other and putting in more legwork to make that fight happen, and then has to try to take out, you know, each base with its own unique challenges. Maybe he has to escape the cop for a bit because the cop isn't willing to go along with him for that journey. And there's an extended sequence where like he needs to get away, but he doesn't want to actually take down this cop who, you know, he's maybe frustrated at for not moving forward as quickly as he would like, but is ultimately on the same side and not the kind of gang guy that he ultimately wants to take out. Like, you could do that. That's a thing that could have happened.
Yeah, I think adding just some sort of like better pacing to the action scenes, or some sort of overarching build to it, because I mean, watching, if I'm gonna bring Hard Boiled up again, because it's a really good movie, each one of the action scenes mm-hmm. in that movie like builds and builds and builds until there's so much tension. Like the climax of the movie takes place in a hospital, and it's like they're trying to save one guy from getting killed in the hospital. Turns out not just one guy is there, there's a whole like there's like an entire arms casing in the basement that's like been hidden by the local gang. So they got to get down to that, but then they realize the entire like building is rigged to just blow. So they got to get everybody out, but then there's babies in there, and then the fire starts, and it's like it builds and builds and builds till there's so much tension in the movie that it's like the action scene's really exciting. And I just, you don't get that with Silent Night. The one thing the one action scene I really, really liked was when he first got to the building and he's like climbing up the stairs. And it's like more and more guys are coming down the stairs. I love a good stair climb action scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was like, okay, yep, this is good. And then the action kind of stalled when the woman like just broke through the wall and just shot them. And you're like, oh, wait, what? Why are they both like lying bleeding on the floor? the cop and.
Yeah, she was a weird. Go ahead. She was a weird like mini boss. Like, it was weird to have your like penultimate moment, and it kind of fell a little flat because she was just a very odd character in general.
Yeah, it felt like they were trying to like make her someone we were supposed to empathize with. Like they focus a lot on her and how she's being drugged up, and theoretically, like this is meant to be like this gang leader abusing her via, you know, drug manipulation and whatever else. And then she's just a mini boss that needs to be taken out. And it's like, okay, I really felt like you were trying to go somewhere with this and then decided that you didn't have any way to pay it off. So now she's just another person that you need to take out. In my head, I was just like, no, not heroin girl. She was the one person in this gang building that maybe didn't need to die, but nope. That's there we go. Yeah.
Which is also a bummer because there was the other mob boss. There was the mob boss that he didn't kill in the car shootout that then showed back up and in the billiards room.
That was a good fight.
So I don't know. That was a good fight. But again, it was one of those like this guy Kinnaman's character felt like he was too good at it.
Yeah.
Considering he had spent like 6 months learning YouTube videos, like I don't know. It definitely it should not have been John Wick. But I can understand being like, well, I want John Wick. So, but that being said, Justin, as you are the guest, we shall start with you. We do ask for a final score, and we use a 10-point scale. Do you have a score, and do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah. Out of 10, I'm always so bad with out of 10. I don't want to be too harsh, because I like to give it the benefit of the doubt. I think it did some really interesting and challenging things. Like it's difficult to do a movie without dialogue. And I will say I watched No One Will Save You earlier, which is the other movie that also had no dialogue this year, which is strange that there are two coming latter half of the year when we're also in the middle of a writer's strike. We're not going to go into that. But I think Silent Night did it a little bit better than No One Will Save You. People seem to like No One Will Save You a lot more. I didn't super love it just because the moments where they had to tell the story visually rather because they didn't have dialogue just felt so stiff. And I didn't get that as much here. Like the no dialogue, I think, worked. But I think it also, both movies together, made a solid argument for not making a movie without dialogue. And just an argument for how vital dialogue is. So if I had to boil down my feelings for Silent Night, I'd probably give it a 4 out of 10. But it's a positive 4. It is a, like, there were 4 things I really liked in this movie.
That's reasonable. That's a reasonable way to put it. Chase, what about you?
I will be slightly more kind. I'm going to give it a 5 out of 10. They're definitely, like, when it gets there, it has some fun sequences. And I do like that opening sequence a lot. The pacing is just, it's just rough. And as someone who likes dialogue and is very character driven in terms of how I tend to enjoy films, I think this is one where maybe the ambition got away from capitalizing on the film's potential. But there is some good stuff in there. And even the stuff that I didn't think was like factually good, like I think Out of Pocket was a perfect way to describe that last montage sequence with like in the golden orb with, you know, imagining this future with his son as he's strangling this gang
without
leader.
His wife too.
Like the wife's not there. She doesn't get to be part of the montage, which that's a whole other, I guess, thing to unpack. But like, was that sequence good? I know, Did I enjoy it? Yeah, absolutely. That was camp. And I could have used, you know, the numerous directions this film could have gone that I could have ended up enjoying it more. But as it stands, I'll give it a 5.
And you know what? We're going to count it up. I'm going to give it a 6. Mm-hmm. And the only reason I give it a 6 instead of a 5 is I don't disagree with anything either of you guys said. The reason I'm going to give it that extra point is that I woke up the next morning and I had a different thought on it. Mm-hmm. And it was something I'm going to reward it for, a base kind of action movie that, as I said before, it's kind of a mediocre revenge movie. You want a movie about a guy that has to learn things to get revenge on his family? Go watch Law Abiding Citizen, right? You want to see a dude teach himself a whole bunch of shit, that way he can get revenge on somebody that killed his family? Go watch Law Abiding Citizen. That movie is fucking fantastic. But this movie, it made me think, right? And the next morning I woke up, had this different thought about it, and I'm going to reward John Woo for that, because I wouldn't have expected a John Woo film to be something that I would really kind of like chew on a little bit and have a different, you know, thought about it a day later. I think that this would be a great movie to put on FX. Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to work on television without dialogue, so I hope he made enough money, you know, off of the theatrical release and, you know, the first couple of weeks of it being on streaming, because I think this is where this movie kind of settles down. I don't think it's going to be the next action Christmas cult classic a la Die Hard, because Die Hard is, in fact, a Christmas movie. But with that being said, Justin, thank you so much for coming on. It was a pleasure talking with you, and perhaps we will need to have you back on again. Perhaps Chase can convince me to watch another pretentious movie that you guys talk about. I've really kind of expanded my repertoire this year with some Bollywood films, so maybe I need to get into some pretentious art culture type cinema. But is there anything you would like to plug? Social media, anything like that?
Not too much, but I just want to say thank you for having me on. It was a blast. I had a good time.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks so much for coming, man. Maybe when we do our Godzilla Minus One, because you are the Godzilla head in my friend group. And oh boy, is there a lot to talk about with that one that I'm excited about. Yeah.
Spoilers, yeah. Chase. Spoilers.
Thank you so much for coming, man.
Thank you.
Chase, where can the good folks at home find you on the internet?
You can find me at Chase Wassenaar on the artist formerly known as Twitter. Maybe not for very long. It seems it's becoming a scarier place by the day, and I feel like maybe it's about time that I mosey on to greener pastures, like chasewassenaar.bsky.social. But of course, you can follow the podcast itself, both now available on BSky. We got Blue Sky set up over there, so go follow us on that channel. I'm going to try to do a better job of tweeting out over there now that we have a place that isn't Twitter to promote our stuff. And of course, you know, if you like this show and you like video games, we do a video game podcast called Steam Cleaners every Monday that we're not doing this. You should definitely go check that out in the Rough Drafts feed. Or of course, you know, you have the Steam Cleaners and Final Cut separate feeds. So whatever you like, but yeah, should be a very fun next Steam Cleaners episode, since it's our end of the year looking back at a game that the other person already played. So I hope you'll join us for that.
Yes, I'm very excited to head on over to Steam Cleaners next week and talk about games that we played that the other person played. It's fun. It is one of my favorite episodes of the year, because we get to kind of dip our toes in the other person's gaming world. And yes, Merry Christmas. Rough Drafts Podcast is now on Blue Sky. And yes, I indeed did make a Tar and 28-3 joke in that first post. So congratulations to me. I'm a very smart man. As always, you guys can follow me at C80s_LOL and at C80s.bsky.social. And I don't know, maybe Justin might just be back in 2 weeks, because, yep, we're talking about Godzilla in 2 weeks. I'm super excited. I'm not going to force Justin to show up if he doesn't want to. But Godzilla's the next episode, so come back in 2 weeks for Godzilla Minus One. And until then, goodbye, Internet.